from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The teaching and study of the liberal arts, this week on Soundings. My guests are Daryl Gless of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Barbara Hernstein Smith of Duke University. Daryl Gless and Barbara Hernstein Smith were among the organizers of a recent conference sponsored by the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Duke University. The conference was entitled Liberal Arts Education in the Late 20th Century: Emerging Conditions, Responsive Practices. Also participating in the following conversation is Kent Mulliken, my colleague at the National Humanities Center. Here is Barbara Hernstein Smith.
Well, like other battles of the books, the controversy is not over books, but over, I would say, the control of institutions. Here, what we're talking about is control of the Literary Academy, which would include the conception of its mission and the nature of the procedures that it follows. The battles are being fought by people who are united in being persuaded that what and how young people read in school makes a crucial difference in what they're going to believe and how they're going to see the world and how they're going to treat each other. But what divides us is our notion of what they should believe and how they should see the world and how they should treat each other.
Let me stop you. Give me a specific example. Furnish me with a particular point in what the literary canon or the literary, what is not canonical, what is unacceptable, quote unquote. What might you have in mind?
Well, let me put it a different way. I'll say something more about who the battle is between. I'd say, from my own point of view, the battle is being fought by people who have not different views, let's say, of the value of Shakespeare's works, but people who see blacks and women, Asians and Hispanics, Jews and Catholics, gays and lesbians as members of another species or foreign invaders or representatives of quote-unquote special interest groups. And on the other side, people who recognize them as altogether homegrown fellow citizens and a major portion of the faculty and student body of America's schools today. And let me just add this. They're also being fought between people who are still waiting for the theory fad to blow over and everything to return the way it was or remembered to have been 40 years ago, and people who recognize that the theoretical studies of the past generation are irreversible.
Well, we'll come to theory in a few minutes. Daryl Gless, are we going to throw Shakespeare out of our schools because he was a white European male? I remember hearing the term lately, doom, dead European white male. These are the villains in the piece?
Certainly not, as I said on Saturday morning at the conference, the Duke UNC conference. Those of us who have taken the trouble to read some of the newer works by women, by black authors, those things which are being included in the canon, are and yet our teachers ourselves of Shakespeare are no longer scared. That is what is going to happen with Shakespeare in the classroom is I think a new set of questions are going to be asked of the Shakespearean text, and they are being asked of the Shakespearean text now. People are noticing different things. They are fundamentally parts of those of Shakespearean text, and yet they have changed the tone and the direction of discussion.
In previous battles of the books...
Here, this is Kent Mulliken.
And as Wayne said, that you could make a case for the tradition of the liberal arts being a continuing battle of the books, but I think back to the Renaissance when English humanists were concerned about the educational methods and reforms of Pierre Ramus from France. There you have one national tradition being a little suspicious of another, as is often the case between the English and the French. Mm-hmm. And in the 18th century, you have a party who set up to defend the ancients against the moderns. Are those strands still in play in the current battles?
Barbara Smith?
Well, I would say that the canon, the battle of the books, the battle over the canon, is and was always a strictly symbolic issue, that it's an abbreviation for other broader issues and an allegory of other more crucial ideological and political battles. One clue to this is the amount of attention that is attracted from public officials and politicians and the press. You'll recall that used to be that when journalists talked about humanists, it was only to make fun of our conventions. Now there's an awful lot of attention that's being paid. Another clue along the same line is the fact that the issues and the events are dependably misreported and the motives of those involved are dependably and repeatedly misrepresented. You can talk till the cows come home about the fact that Chaucer and Milton and Shakespeare are still being taught, and that no one is saying that Jacqueline Suzanne is just as good as Edith Wharton, and that deconstruction is not a disease but a critical approach. But I think the important thing to stress here is that the description of what's happening is part of the stakes of the battle, and that once you've allowed your enemies. Description to be accepted, you've already conceded defeat.
How about this, Kent Mulliken?
Barbara Herndstein Smith has mentioned a very important word in the current controversies, and that word is ideology. What relation do the liberal arts have to ideological and political concerns?
Well, to get onto that question that I was hoping would come later, one thing that really needs to be sorted out, I think, is the way in which such terms are employed in the current debate. Ideology and politics are constantly being used in different ways by different participants in the debate. If you read Lynn Cheney, the National Endowment for the Humanities chairman's report on the humanities, politics is being used as a purely local, temporary, contemporary, immediate sense. That is, current debates between contending factions and among Republicans and Democrats. Everyone else in the discussions in the academy is using the term in a very different sense, a much more complicated sense. The variety, that terrific tangle of ways in which groups and individuals affect and enforce and coerce other groups and individuals. So the ideology in question, the question of ideology, is a very complicated one. And what's happening in the classrooms is that people are beginning to discover that literary works of art, however durable, do have political implications. And one of the functions of literary interpretation nowadays is to discover those.
Yeah, Barbara Smith?
Sure, I'd agree. In fact, I'd say that, while one of the most common accusations now is that the teaching of literature has become ideological and politicized, the reply is that, of course, the teaching of literature has always been ideological and political, but that the particular form of ideology in politics was invisible because it was so taken for granted and so established. Let me give you an example, okay? And this is precisely what happened to me, I'd say, in the mid-60s. As a reader, you see what your own experiences and perspective and interests allow you to see. If you're a man and a traditionalist, you may be inclined to see in Milton's misogyny, that is his representation of Delilah in Samson Agonistes, his work, you may see this treatment as acceptable or unimportant. If you're a woman and a feminist, it's going to be more noticeable and it's going to make you uncomfortable. And then you have a choice. What are you going to do? If you're going to be a critic and a teacher, are you going to emphasize it or are you going to discount it? Are you going to try to explain it or are you going to try to excuse it? I think that the point is that no matter which decision you make, it's going to be a political and ideological decision. Although if you're excusing it and discounting it, you might say that you're paying attention to purely literary criteria. But even that exclusion was a political and ideological one.
Daryl, bless.
Yes, I'd just like to add to that. The point is that if recent theoretical discussions have done anything, they've helped us recognize that what one brings to the work of art is always a part of the work of art we perceive. When you're dealing with texts like Shakespeare's or Milton's, your reading is always selective. You must, in order to control or to have an understanding of what you take to be an understanding of that work, you must always select parts and allow others to fall into the background. Kids nowadays in the college classroom are noticing things like, for instance, the neglected women in Julius Caesar, in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. They think about what Portia has to do to be taken seriously by her husband Brutus. She has to make herself, in effect, in the course of a long, complicated speech, into a man who has the strength to stab herself in the leg, to deny her natural feelings, so that he'll recognize her, he'll notice her, and it's a dehumanizing process. Kids notice that today. That's always been in the text. But until now, people hadn't taken it seriously. Until now, it was the tragedy of Brutus, a person too devoted to abstract ideas to be devoted to other people.
Kent Mulliken?
Are you saying, Daryl, that what is different about teaching, let's say, Shakespeare today, is that though in the past we were always aware that there were political dimensions, let us say, to Shakespeare's history, plays, the political dimension of Shakespeare's own age. Nowadays, we are also aware of the overlay of political dimensions that pertain more to our age.
I think the difference is that although there have always been political dimensions, we, until lately, only lately, have begun to notice that it's our political ideas that have always been what we perceive to be the politics of the Renaissance.
How about this, Barbara Hernstein-Smith?
Yes, I would definitely second that. I think that what we're recognizing now is that in teaching the politics of the past, we were always speaking from the politics of the present.
Daryl, does this conversation about the political and ideological concerns in literary interpretation lead us to what is known as the new historicism? And could you say a few words about what it is?
It's a very complicated movement, so you can't sum it up simply. But one of the points that will connect with our earlier conversation is this. Until recently, we would take a historian of ideas like E.M.W. Tillyard and say he has described the political structure and the historical outlook, the outlook of the 16th century reader or theater goer. What a new historical critic like Stephen Greenblatt will do will be to show you why it is that in the early 40s in England, E.M.W. Tillyard was so anxious to see the 16th century as a world of perfectly ordered hierarchies which were somehow rationally conceived and controlled by a deity. This was because, in part, Greenblatt will argue, of the disruptions in Europe. It's in partly a kind of nostalgia that allows you to see the past in ways that you would like the present to be. So it's always a self-consciousness about how we construct the past in light of the present.
Kent Mulliken?
Well, to coin a phrase, if politics comes, can economics be far behind? And I would like to ask both of you, Daryl Glessier, an associate dean at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You have to worry not only about course structures, but budgets for them. And Barbara Hernstein-Smith, you're the president of one of the major learned societies in the United States, the Modern Language Association, which also has to be concerned about the support, public and private, for what it is scholars do. What about the economics of higher education? Where are the liberal arts in the structure of the university and in the universe of funding today?
Well, one of the things that seems to be emerging from our recent looks at the MLA, at surveys and statistics of changing majors over the past, let's say, 20 years, is that the humanities have been not doing badly at all, although probably it could be said that all of the liberal arts, that would be the social sciences, the sciences, and the humanities, are showing declines in comparison with business courses and business degrees and engineering degrees. There's also a question of the nature of the majors and the kinds of requirements that would be put into place by such degrees and what opportunities there would be for students to study humanities courses, even if they loved them. Which I believe they do, and that what I'm aware of when I go around the country is how many students there are who would speak to me about how much more they would want to be able to take these courses, but they literally don't have the time from the kinds of majors that I'm describing. Daryl probably knows even more about that.
I can't give you statistics, but one thing that is happening is that students are getting over the recent terror, the careerist terror that they've had to live through, in which everyone was telling them they could not study literature or philosophy or history and hope to survive in the world of work. Increasingly, they're getting the message that to study the liberal arts is to prepare yourself for an active life in which you can make it. Consequently, the numbers are turning around.
Kent Mulliken.
I think it's encouraging indeed that more students are turning to the liberal arts, and I'm prompted somewhat mischievously to pose the following question. In ancient times, I understand that it was a practice of the Romans to have the engineer of a bridge stand beneath it while the first heavily laden cart traversed it, and you're both teachers in colleges of liberal arts. If you were sending a child to college, would you advise her or him to major in the liberal arts, and why?
Absolutely, though. I'd try to do it very carefully so that they wouldn't refused to do it because I advised it. The parental problem there. But I would certainly advise it. I've had such wonderful students over the last 10 years who have gone on to work on Wall Street and to go to law school and then up to major law firms, all of whom are extremely successful there and extremely happy that they had the background that they did have. And I suspect they're likely to be doing better work, more humane work in those careers than they would have otherwise.
Barbara Hernstein-Smith?
The question is often put, what's the payoff? What's the bottom line? If when you become an engineer, you're able to build bridges, what is it that you're able to do? What's happened to you if you studied the humanities? And I think part of the problem is that humanists have been too eager to say that it's something sublime, that it's something transcendent, or that you shouldn't even mention payoffs in connection with the study of the humanities. What I'd say is that there are continuous payoffs, that it occurs throughout one's life, that it doesn't have the palpability, immediacy, and visibility and photographability, perhaps, of a bridge, but that it becomes who you are. Certainly the tremendous energy that you see professors now putting into the debate over the canon, which I said before at the very beginning, is a matter of what you believe and how you think of the world and how you treat each other. It is precisely because we think that what you read and how you read it in school is going to affect that all of these battles have that much energy.
Let me ask you to follow up the points of your conversation up to now, Barbara Hernstein-Smith and Daryl Glass. You've talked about the canon. You've talked about what kids should study. Part of the debate that rages in this battle of the books obviously is interpretive. It has to do with the theoretical aspects, what the professors themselves are thinking. What about the students and their qualifications? We have much ado about cultural literacy in America. Secondary students, college students. Are we selling books or are we talking about issues when we use terms like that? Daryl?
Well, certainly some people are selling books very effectively on that theme. One thing that seems extremely important to think about when we refer to the National Endowment for the Humanities report recently is the kind of reasoning that occurs in that place, in that kind of document. One of the things that's being said is that universities are not taking Western culture seriously because those universities are prescribing students take courses in non-Western civilization. What's happening is a constant effort to demand that we take Western culture seriously by teaching courses and by requiring courses in Western civilization, American history, and so on.
And the charge, just parenthetically, is that American universities are not doing that as a matter of course?
That's very explicitly the charge, and when it comes from Bill Bennett, the recent Secretary of Education, it comes out even worse. He says that we are trashing Western civilization because we're asking students to study things which are non-Western. The point is that they look at a university curriculum that contains just hundreds of courses on Western civilization. And because that university presents one or two courses in non-Western civilization, ask students to take it. Therefore, they argue, we're trashing Western civilization. It's a ridiculous argument.
Barbara Hernstein-Smith?
It's almost as if teaching itself is being seen as a football game, and the question is whether we have enough on our side, or it becomes a question of patriotism, a stand up for the West. This is a tremendous misunderstanding, both of the nature of the changes, and also, I would say, the mission of the Literary Academy, which, although it is changing, continuously, would certainly have always, for a long time, have declared itself as broadening, making one more aware of the rest of the world. What was the point?
Mm-hmm. Kent Mulliken?
It's clear from recent discussions and from this program that canon has become a very problematical term. Is tradition a better term? And tradition, as Eliot defined it, and tradition and the individual talent, a constantly changing body of learning?
I would say that you don't avoid the problem by giving it another title. Even if you began to call it tradition, then the same questions would arise. Who gets to name the tradition? What are the considerations in relation to which traditional works got cited alongside of one another, in relation to what blindnesses and particularities and interests were writings that were published at the same time, lost to view, never visible?
haven't there always been good writings that were lost to view? It seems to me, to return to T.S. Eliot, that he restored Donne and the Metaphysicals to a position of greater prestige.
I think what you could say is that the interest of writings are going to always be variable in relation to other interests at various times. What I have just said is going to be called relativism. Mm-hmm.
Darrell Glass?
I was just going to say that the example of Eliot might comfort us all. What he did was to resurrect some very fine poets from the 17th century, and did it in part at the expense of another very fine poet of the 17th century, Milton, who has also been more recently recuperated. And in fact, I take as a sign of great excitement in my own classrooms, The Paradise Lost is one of the favorite poems my students come across nowadays.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the teaching and study of the liberal arts. My guests were Darrell Gless of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Barbara Hernstein-Smith of Duke University, and Kent Mulliken of the National Humanities Center. Soundings concludes now with commentary by Joseph Lowenstein of Washington University. The subject of his remarks is Humanities in America, a report to the American people written and recently released by Lynn V. Cheney, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Here is Joseph Lowenstein.
There is a good deal to admire in the recent report by Lynn Cheney, chairman of the NEH, on the humanities in America. Her report is full of well-founded hope and useful suggestions, but it also contains several unexamined assumptions and thus a good deal of inappropriate censure. One of these assumptions is that professors of the humanities have no business speaking in tongues not readily understood, or thinking about problems not obviously pressing. Thus, the NEH has put its stamp on the dreary old attack on academics for using jargon and succumbing to overspecialization. Dr. Cheney traces the tendency to specialized research in the humanities back to the mid-19th century founding of Johns Hopkins, the first American university dedicated primarily to research. She suggests that as other universities followed the Hopkins model, America's professors were lured into over-specialization and professional cant. Outside the university, we are told, people speak plain English. Inside it, they now speak a specialist jargon. Although Dr. Cheney says a few respectful things about specialization in the humanities, by and large, her report glows with nostalgia for the good old days when the best that had been felt and thought could be set forth in language that was simple and passionate. Yet one of our oldest surviving intellectual traditions has a healthy respect for specialized language. Aristotle, surely an NEH hero, spoke plain Greek in the afternoons, but jargon in the mornings. In the afternoons, he offered lectures to what was then the general public. Aristotle called these public lessons his exoteric works. In the morning, he spoke to the students of his academy, and these lectures, which survive as notes and summaries, came to be known as his esoteric or academic works. This body of thought, inaccessible to the general public of Athens, is now the most important, the most widely respected portion of Aristotle's work. Like many modern professors, Aristotle knew that he had a responsibility not only to communicate his knowledge to the largest possible public, but also to prepare, in the company of highly trained specialists, a legacy of difficult knowledge for the future. For that, he had to employ forms of expression and forms of argument that the man on the street in ancient Athens would have found incomprehensible. Newton's calculus was similarly academic, similarly esoteric in his day. Thanks to the resources of a community of specialists and an esoteric mathematical notation, Newton's calculus has become the math of college freshmen, even of high school students. Now, antiquity isn't all that esoteric language has going for it. After all, one man's jargon is another man's native tongue. One woman's overspecialization is another's specialty. We have every right to ask our professors to be comprehensible when they speak to the public at large, just as we can occasionally demand clarity of our lawyers, legislators, and doctors. But we would be foolish to stigmatize the doctor for distinguishing antigens from mitogens in her professional publications. We would be similarly mistaken to deny that the gobbledygook of law has often enabled our courts to protect the innocent. I will testify that professors of the humanities are going about their esoteric work responsibly and ardently when they distinguish parataxis from hypotaxis, phatic utterance from metalingual, or sex from gender. And those who wish to join in the struggle with those distinctions, to submit to the rigors of the morning lecture, rather than scorning it as academic or esoteric, will find that there is much to learn, much to feel, and perhaps much to value as a calculus for the future.
Joseph Lowenstein teaches at Washington University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he's at work on a study of intellectual property in Renaissance Europe. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on the Teaching and Study of the Liberal Arts is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 435. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the first in a series of four conversations for Black History Month, February 1989. The topic will be From Protest to Power, the Recent History of Civil Rights in the United States. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor seminars on two topics, literature and its audiences, and the concept of republicanism. These enrichment programs are for high school teachers of literature and history. For an application, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 1989. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The last week in January and the first week in February marked the anniversary of the Greensboro lunch counter protest in early February 1960. The first soft landing on the moon occurred at the end of January 1966 when the Soviet Union's Luna 9 transmitted pictures back to Earth. And the American revolutionary leader Thomas Paine, the Irish writer James Joyce, and the American baseball player Jackie Robinson have birthdays during the last week in January and the first week in February. Thomas Paine in 1737, James Joyce in 1882, and Jackie Robinson in 1919. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Battle of the Books continues this week on Soundings. Listen for a discussion about the teaching and study of the liberal arts with Daryl Glass of the University of North Carolina and Barbara Herrnstein Smith, president of the Modern Language Association. What should American undergraduates know, and how should the professors teach it? The Battle of the Books, the second of two conversations, this week on Soundings.